Hey, Gray. So last season, we covered the issue of halakhic wills, but one area that we did not have a chance to fully cover was the halakhic living will. So we're going to discuss a little bit some of the issues of the halakhic living will. This is not a monetary document, but it's still one that does result in a fair amount of consultation with the Beis Din. This is when people are preparing for different eventualities at the end of life. When they might be in a state where they're not going to be mentally competent to make decisions, and there will have to be halakhic decisions made regarding whether or not to resuscitate, regarding whether or not to intubate, and a host of various other types of decisions. The way in which the halakhic living will form that is promulgated by the CRC, really in conjunction with the Chayim Aruchim organization here in Chicago, together with the Aguda of Illinois, I think we all use the same form, is that it doesn't give a plethora of different options for a person to figure out, oh, well, if they're in a particular compromised physical or medical state, so then they're going to decide ahead of time whether they're in favor of administering antibiotics, not in favor, whether they're in favor of extraordinary life extending treatments or not, whether a person who might need dialysis or chemotherapy is going to authorize that it be a continued or discontinued. There are so many different decisions that may need to be made in the heat of the moment or in the thick of things, when a person is in that particular state of affairs, that can't necessarily be planned for or fully anticipated or fully thought out when a person is filling out a form like this years ahead of time. And also, we don't know what new medical technologies are going to develop, what new treatments are going to develop, and there are also halakhic issues that are implicated that a person might not necessarily be fully cognizant of what is considered to be permissible or recommended or mandatory according to the halakha. So in order to address many of these issues and avoid many of the vagaries and problems, the way that the form works is that there are just a couple of default propositions. The default propositions are that as a matter of halakha, we obviously don't endorse the notion of actively hastening a person's death. That would be considered ritzika. That would be considered to be murder according to Jewish law. According to halakha, you can't take a living person and, for example, disconnect them from a respirator. You can sometimes make decisions not to put somebody on a respirator to begin with, or not to administer certain treatments to begin with, but at least you could say as a default proposition that a person does not want to be subject to any kind of active euthanasia. You could also say as a default proposition that a person does not want any autopsies to be performed, because halakha as a general matter believes that the body has to be treated in a sacred fashion once it is dead, and it has to be expeditiously buried, and one is not supposed to desecrate or defile a dead body. So we generally are against autopsies. Furthermore, there is certainly a desire that the body be submitted for a speedy burial. So those are some of the default propositions that a person would want to record in a document of this sort. But beyond that, since most of the other decisions are very case-specific, and there are all kinds of halakhic issues, so the two major provisions of the document is that a person names a power of attorney, somebody whom they trust to make decisions on their behalf. And number two, they also say that they want to adhere to requirements of Jewish law, and they name a rabbi or rabbinic organization that's page 6 of this form, that should be consulted in the event that their proxy needs to make any kind of halakhic decision or determination. They say, okay, here's the rabbi who should be consulted. That rabbi is not available. Then a different rabbi should be consulted in their stead. So sometimes parties, rather than naming a particular rabbi, will name, if you look on page 7, an institutional organization. An institutional organization, they'll name the Chicago Rabbinical Council, or they'll name Agudat Yisrael of Illinois, and when a person calls up, they'll be referred to the appropriate rabbinic authorities that can help them make these types of decisions. So the big elephant in the room when it comes to any of these healthcare medical forms and proxies, which is not explicitly addressed in this form, probably for good reason, as we're going to see, is what about organ donation? Because some of the proponents of filling out these types of forms and even putting certain instructions on one's driver's license, things of that sort, are really very much in favor of parties making these types of provisions and instructions for the purpose of authorizing that in the event that they die, that their organs and their bodies should be used to help to save and to treat other people who could benefit from their organs. I'm sure you're familiar with the Halakhic Organ Donors Society. Somebody mentioned that to me before we began this year, that this is part of what people sometimes inquire about. They think, oh, perhaps at the time in the event that they should die, they would want to at least be able to assist somebody else through the donation of organs. Of course, we have a concept of donation of organs even during one's lifetime. We know that sometimes people donate kidneys, for example. There are a lot of tshuvos about whether it's permissible or whether it is forbidden or whether it is recommended for somebody to donate a kidney. Some of the early poskim weren't so much in favor because they thought that, you know, it could be a little bit of a dangerous procedure or operation. Others said there's a machlokas between the Talmud Bavli, Talmud Yerushalmi, whether a person is obligated to place themselves in possible danger in order to save somebody else from certain danger. The Talmud Yerushalmi holding that, this quoted by the Beis Yosef, that a person is obligated to place themselves in dubious danger in order to save somebody else from clear danger, from obvious danger, where they would otherwise die. And the Talmud Bavli saying there's no such obligation. And then there's the question, well, if there's no such obligation, do you have the right to do that? Most poskim say that you do have the right to do that as long as the amount of danger is not greater than 50%. That's what most poskim hold. Although the Tzitz Eliezer indicates that maybe if you read the Radbaz carefully, it seems like maybe the Radbaz is saying that Sopek Didei Adif Mivada Dechavre, that this is maybe something which would not be allowed. But the Bavli certainly doesn't say that it's obligatory to do such a thing. On the other hand, some of the later poskim point out that if the amount of danger is extremely infinitesimal for a person to donate something, let's say you're going to donate blood and will save somebody's life and the danger of donating blood is practically non-existent, or you're going to donate donate bone marrow, and nowadays it's very unobtrusive to donate bone marrow and it could save somebody's life because somebody is a match, so there's a possibility that that would really be obligatory because of the fact that there's no real danger at all. Now that kidney transplants have become much safer and effective than they ever were in the past, so you find among poskim much more of a tendency to recommend that if somebody finds that they're a match and they could save somebody else's life by donating a kidney, that this is something which is much more advocated and recommended and pushed than it was in the past. I think we'd fall a little short of saying that it's absolutely obligatory, but it's certainly something which is highly, you know, recommended and endorsed in those situations where there's an evaluation that the risk is very, very small and you could save somebody's life.
With kidneys, is part of the discussion, unlike bone marrow that's going to regenerate, the kidney that the person is healthy can give them a kidney now. If people have concerns, in 2 decades from now, I may need that kidney. Is that part of the discussion?
It's part of the discussion. Generally speaking, you have to look at the literature. It's found that it's pretty safe for a person to donate a kidney. Generally speaking, I'm not, you know, posking that you have to run out and donate kidneys right now, but I'm saying it's becoming much more prevalent because it's considered much safer than it was certainly a number of years ago. But this is, yes.
Maybe you're going to cover this later, but it seems to me if it's okay to give a kidney while I'm alive, it certainly should be okay when I'm dead, when there's no risk to me.
You'd figure, right? Okay, so this is all during a person's lifetime. Now, obviously, there's certain things you can't donate during your lifetime. You can't donate your heart during your lifetime. So if a person donates their life during their lifetime, it's not going to be their lifetime anymore. So there's a limitation in terms of what a person's really going to be able to donate. They're not going to donate their cornea during the lifetime because they want to be able to see. They're not going to donate their liver during their lifetime because everybody really needs their liver. So there are certain things that are just completely out of the question. I'm sorry? But you can't donate your entire liver during your lifetime.
But part of that discussion is, you know, while you're alive, yes. While you're totally dead, no. But if you're in the sukkah, then it might kill you.
It's a question, right. So we only really have two categories in halacha. So it would seem we have being alive and we have being dead. You know, being a little bit dead, you know, it's not like being a little pregnant, like either a person is dead or they're not dead. So the question arises, what types of organ donations can a person really authorize upon their death? First of all, is it okay to just donate your organs upon your death? There are tshuvos by the Nodav Yehuda and by the Chassam Sofer where they both say that, let's say an individual died and they did it. Authorized for an organ to be donated during their death, but when they die, this is what we call a chola lefanenu. So the Nodav Yehuda uses this terminology. It's a chola lefanenu. There's a sick person in the next bed, and that person's life can be saved if we would take an organ from the person who just died. The Nodav Yehuda's case was a little bit different. If we would do an autopsy on the person who just died and figure it out exactly what caused the person to die, and based on that analysis, we'd be able to then rescue the person who's in the next bed. But it's the same idea in terms of harvesting an organ. And the Nodav Yehuda says, if it's a kol lepaneinu, we don't need the person's prior permission. We can't ask them permission now because they're dead. But we don't need their prior permission before they died in order to save another individual. Because pikuach nefesh is docheh kol yisurim shebetorah. What are these sermons that we're worried about? An expeditious burial, an isur hanav, the prohibition to derive benefit from a dead person, the prohibition of nivul hames, the prohibition of desecrating or defiling a dead body. None of these are the big three. None of these are killing somebody. It's not shvichos damim. It's not a vote. It's not Giloy Arayos. So as long as it's not the big three, we would violate every other Isser in the Torah in order to save somebody's life. So you don't really need the person's permission. That's what they claim. Not everybody agrees with that. The Binyan Sion disagrees with that. The Minchas Moed, in terms of the contemporary postgame, one second, the Minchas Yitzchak disagrees with that. They say, no, if somebody is dead, they're chafshi min mitzvos. So they're not obligated to perform any mitzvos. So therefore, I don't have a right to take away from them. I'm not going to be able to really reimburse them afterwards. So I don't have a right to take away from them if they didn't endorse having their body defiled in order to save somebody's life, so then I have no right to do that. I think that's more the minority approach, but there is such an approach. So some say even to save somebody's life, you would need consent. But let's say you have consent. Let's say you have consent. But you have consent that a person said, I want to donate my body to science. Okay, so do we then say, okay, well then we're going to take the person's body and we'll just allow the scientists to research and do work on this person's, you know, body in order to become more knowledgeable about the human body or to help a medical student so learn about medicine. Is that considered to be a sufficient pressing need to allow for the utilization of a person's body after they died, even if they did get permission? The Chassam Sofer has a tshuva, I think it's Siman Shin Lamed Vav in Yoredei, and it's tshuvas in Yoredei. The Chassam Sofer says no, that when a prerequisite, whether you have, you could say that that maybe you don't need consent, maybe you do need consent, but one prerequisite in order to be able to to defile a body after death is that you're going to actually save somebody's life. You're not going to save somebody's life. The body's just vaguely being given over to medicine. So then he says that wouldn't be good enough, and we would not allow for a body to be defiled on that basis. Because then he quotes a Ramban. The Ramban says that if this person doesn't have respect for the body that was given to him by a Kodesh Baruch Hu, you have to realize this, it's Selam Elokim, so he wasn't Chasal Kavod Kono, so then maybe that is not a reason for us not to be concerned about the respect that should be shown to the Selam Elokim that was created by a Kodesh Baruch Hu. So therefore, it would seem that if we had to narrow down what is considered to be acceptable according to all of the opinions, if we're going to be concerned about the opinions that say you need consent no matter what, the opinion of the Chassam Sofer says you need a chol lefenenu, you need to be able to save somebody's life who's in danger, so then you really need a combination of two different circumstances in order to really authorize for the donation of a person's organs after their death. Number one, they gave permission. And that's why it's important that such things would be recorded either in a living will or that a person submits to the opinion and decision of a rabbinic authority that can make that decision on their behalf. That would also be presumably okay, although it would be preferable, presumably, if the person had stated their preference that they're mochel, that they give permission even before they die to that rabbinic authority. And number two, it would have to be that the organ that's going to be harvested is going to be used in order to save a chol lefenenu, somebody who is sick and in dire need of that organ in order to save their life at that moment in time. What if there isn't anybody who's sick and in dire need that we know about at that point in time? Can we just say, well, there probably will be a chol lefenenu somewhere in the universe at that point in time? There probably will be somebody in the community, somebody in Eretz Yisrael, somebody who's going to be in need of that organ, and therefore, on that basis, we should allow for the donation of the organ. So the Sri Deyeshua of Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg was of the opinion that nowadays, where there is communication between different hospitals, different communities, even if when the person dies, we don't know exactly who the chol lefenenu is, who exactly is the person who needs the organ, we haven't identified them per se, there's just a list of different individuals who are supposed to receive organs, that's good enough. That also counts as a chol lefenenu. But this is also part of what has to be determined. So some poskim would say that if a person's going to make a decision that they want to donate an organ upon their death, that really the best way to go about it is for them to, number one, give their permission, and number two, to say, but this is only assuming that there is a chol lefenenu, that there is a sick person who at that moment in time of death, when the organ is harvested, really needs the organ in order to be saved, just to cover all bases. And then the question is...
A waiting list, though. Everything has a waiting list.
I said, according to the Sri Deyeshua, might be good enough, but different poskim may differ as to whether the waiting list is good enough or whether we really need to be able to identify somebody, you know, specifically at that moment in time. Another question is, what if the person authorizes for a donation of a part of an organ that's not going to save somebody's life? Let's say it's a cornea. A cornea transplant is not necessarily going to save somebody's life. It's going to be able to give somebody vision, but giving somebody vision is not necessarily going to save their life. So Ravadia Yosef is a tshuva in the Yubi Omer about this, in which he's not so sanguine about necessarily donating a cornea. He said, well, first of all, we have to figure out, is this sufficient? It's one thing if you're going to save somebody's life, that can overcome all these concerns about burial. It can overcome the concern about Isser Hanah, not deriving benefit from a mace and so forth. But does donating a cornea really override all of those concerns? So he says, well, maybe as far as burial is concerned, it's considered like it's being given a new life once it goes into somebody else, so therefore you don't have to worry about burial. Maybe as far as Isser Hanah, that's only if you derive benefit in the normal fashion, but this isn't the normal fashion. He's not 100% sure about that. In terms of a Nivel Hames, so is this considered to be Nivel Hames? Is this considered to be a defilement of the dead body if it's going to be utilized for this purpose, that somebody's going to be able to get some life from it? So Rabbi Vayu Yosef talks about that as well. Maybe if you're really going to, if it's really going to be used in a way that's going to, it's going to save, give somebody else a vision, so maybe we can use that svara, we can say that that's a compelling enough need, that that's going to override the consideration of Nivel Hames as well. Yes?
What would be a normal way to benefit from a dead body? What would be a normal way to benefit?
Yes, that's a good question. So some say that this is like a normal benefit. What else are you going to do with a cornea? Are you going to like play ball with a cornea? You know, like you play ping pong with it. So so that's a question. Rabbi Yosef assumes that it's not derech hanasa. The Nivel Hames consideration, Rabbi Yosef says that as we had mentioned in the other context of even saving somebody's life, that mechila, you know, Nivel Hames, so you're defiling that person, but the person gives his permission, so maybe it's not a Nivel Hames consideration. Then again, the Chassam Sofer, the Ramban as saying, well, even if you don't care about the respect to your body, maybe, you know, what we should care about, the respect that's given to your body. So he says that in a cornea context, it's better that it not come from a Jewish person, because if you're dealing with a non-Jewish mace, maybe there are certain sources that say that they're not restricted in this fashion from deriving benefit from a cadaver. That might be a rule that is imposed upon us based on Xeris Akustiv, upon the Jewish community. So he says that maybe in an ideal circumstance it shouldn't come from a Jewish mace. So we see that it gets a little bit complicated. What exactly can you donate? It's the more you're going to save somebody's life, the more you save somebody's life who's lifanenu, who needs it at the time that the individual dies, and the more in which you can also establish that the person who died gave mechila, gave permission for the body to be used in this fashion, so the better off you're going to be. But there is, let me just add, what really is sort of the springboard for the rest of the discussion that I wanted to get into today. There is yet another consideration. What's that other consideration? The other consideration you have to worry about is that we have this in secular law as well. In secular law, it's not necessarily codified in the statute. It's considered to be a moral principle. When it comes to donation of organs, okay, we have that would otherwise kill a person, like the donation of a heart, the donation of a liver, right? So we have a certain rule that most of the statutes throughout the world, when it comes to donation of organs, most of the practices in the hospitals are all based on this rule, and it is an acronym. And I'll ask you if you can figure out what the acronym stands for. You could if you leaf through the materials. It's called DDR. What does DDR stand for? Can anybody figure that out? No, because that would be DNR. You see, it's DDR, but that's very close, though. You got two out of the three letters.
Don't take something?
No, DDR, okay? Dead donor rule. That's DDR, dead donor rule. Meaning, you may not harvest an organ that would otherwise kill somebody from someone who's still alive, because that would be murder. So therefore, you're only allowed to harvest the organ from a person who's a dead donor. He has to be dead. So here's where the halacha gets a little bit tricky and a little bit sticky, which is at what point in time is the person really dead? And this is very, very important, because for the most part, when you talk about donating organs, okay, other than maybe the cornea, when we talk about donating significant life-saving organs after death, those organs are really only going to be viable, or going to be the most viable, when the heart of the donor is still beating, because then you haven't had tissue degeneration yet, you still have the circulation of blood in the body, and at that point in time, the organ is going to be much more viable and much more capable of saving somebody's life. But if you say, as a matter of halacha, by definition, the heart is still beating, then the person is still alive, so then you violated the dead donor rule, and we also have the dead donor rule in our tradition. We don't call it dead donor rule, we just call it Issa Ritzicha, that you're not allowed to kill somebody, and then you would not be allowed, under those circumstances, even to authorize the donation of your organs. Now, this is certainly true with respect to the heart and the liver. The heart and the liver cannot really be donated if they are taken past the point in time in which the heart is no longer beating and the blood is no longer circulating. What is that time? That time is once the heart starts beating. So then you can't really take the heart or the liver at that point in time. You could take the kidney. However, the kidney also is going to be much less viable if you wait at that point in time. This is the distinction they have in the secular literature between DBD and DCB. Does anybody want to try DBD and DCB? Okay. So DBD is a donation after brain death. That's DBD. Okay. Donation after brain death. And DCD is donation after circulatory death, okay? Donation after circulatory death. What is this term? I just came up with this idea of brain death and circulatory death. What is this all about? So there's such a thing as a question, when do we define the moment of death? And this is where it becomes very, very important from the standpoint of halacha. That if I define death, death was always defined traditionally as the point in time in which a person's heart stops beating and there's no spontaneous respiration. That's what we call cardiorespiratory death. There's no spontaneous respiration. If you would check the nose, you put a feather over the nose, and you wouldn't see it flicker, okay? Because there's no respiration coming out of the nose. And you check the heartbeat, there's no pulse, okay? So there's cardiac death, there's respiratory death. That's how death was always defined. That means the heart's not beating anymore. Heart's not beating anymore. The heart and liver are going to be useless, and the kidney is going to be a lot less useful than it would have been if the heart had been beating. So how could you say that a person's really dead if the heart is still beating? Well, if you maybe define death a little bit differently. There are two different ways that you could define death, where maybe the heart is no longer, where maybe the heart is still beating, right? But nonetheless, we're going to call the person dead. One is that we say the person's not capable of spontaneous respiration, right? That's what we call the ICSR, okay? That is irreversible cessation of spontaneous respiration, okay? ICSR, so that's one possible standard. You say the person's no longer able to have spontaneous respiration, but nonetheless, we're going to pump oxygen into the heart, so the heart's going to continue to be able to beat. So we'll say, well, since the person's not able to have spontaneous respiration, we're going to consider them to be dead. Why would a person not be capable of having spontaneous respiration? Well, what enables the oxygen normally to be pumped, okay? What causes a person to be able to breathe? What causes a person generally to be able to breathe is that there is a mechanism in the person's brain that sends, okay, the oxygen in to the person's body, to the lungs, that enables them to have a spontaneous respiration. And that is something that comes from the brain stem. It comes from the brain stem. The brain is made up of, I'm not a doctor. If anybody here knows more science, medicine than I do, please, you know, pipe in at any point in time, okay? I'm not claiming to be a neurologist, great, you know, brain scientist expert or anything. I'm certainly not a brain surgeon, all right? But there are three different major parts to the brain. There's the cerebrum, the cerebellum, and the brainstem, okay? The cerebrum is what controls, like, more sophisticated thought processes. The cerebellum is what provides, like, certain motor reflexes. And the brainstem is what helps to regulate the body, create a certain stability within the body and homeostasis within the body. And also it feeds the oxygen into the body that enables there to be spontaneous respiration. Once there's spontaneous respiration, the blood circulates throughout the body and the blood and the heart continues to beat. So therefore, if the brain completely ceases to function, and the last part of the brain that's going to break down will be the brain stem, like a person might be in what we call PVS. What's PVS, anybody? PVS? Public television? No. PVS is a persistent vegetative state. A person could be in persistent vegetative state, PVS, right? Which means that their cerebrum doesn't really work anymore. They're not really engaged in any high-level thinking. They can't do that, but the brainstem is perfectly fine. Brainstem is fine. They're able to breathe on their own. They don't have to be connected to any kind of a ventilator, anything of that sort, but they're not responsive to outside stimuli for the most part. They're not really able to conduct a conversation, have any kind of meaningful communication. Think of Terry Schiavo, people who were in that type of a state. They were in PVS, persistent vegetative state, okay? These are people who's don't have a complete curtailing of the brain functions. They don't have a complete breakdown, what we would call the irreversible cessation of all brain function, including the brain stem. That hasn't happened to them. Everybody would agree in medicine that they're considered to be alive. Everybody would agree that they're considered to be alive. And if you would take an organ from these people, that would definitely be, according to everybody, a violation of DDR, the dead donor rule, and that would be an act of a murder. That's not even a question. But here we're talking about something different. When there's irreversible cessation of all brain functions, including the brain stem, okay? In which case, an individual is not going to be capable of spontaneous respiration, and therefore, even if the heart is beating, according to this approach, the people in such a state are considered to be dead. there wasn't really such that, why would the heart still be beating? Because you can pump oxygen. Let's say that it's not coming from the brainstem. No problem. I'll pump oxygen from elsewhere into the heart. Once I pump oxygen from elsewhere into the heart can beat on its own. It's not like I'm taking a dead heart and I'm just artificially causing it to go up and down, up, 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 up. I'm not doing that. The oxygen is doing that. Once there's oxygen, the brain is just beating, the heart is beating on its own. So do we say that person is really alive? Or do we say, no, this is a heart-beating cadaver? I saw that. This is very, very interesting. That the head of the Hodes Society wrote an article just a few weeks ago in which he was saying that it's really a waste of medical resources. Clearly, he was staking out a position, I guess, that his feeling is that brain death really does count as dead, from a halakhic perspective. He says it's a waste of medical resources, that you're just using medical resources in order to take care of a heart-beating cadaver. That's the way that he defined it. But other people would say, no, if the heart's beating, it's not a cadaver. It all depends on exactly how you define your terms. So there is the possibility then, so this is the only time that you could successfully and realistically remove a person's heart and remove a person's liver. So some poskim would say, the whole discussion doesn't get off the ground. If you don't accept brain death, there's a viable definition of death, and you say that death requires that there not be any more beating of the heart, so then as long as the heart is still beating, which is the only time you could remove the heart and the liver and for the most part even have a successful kidney transplant once a person is dead, that would be an act of murder. So how can a person authorize for the organs to be removed at that point in time, and how could we do that to a person to remove the organs at that point in time? So that's why in these forms you won't find a mention of harvesting organs, because for the most part, you're speaking about any of the meaningful organs, it would require an adoption of the definition of death, halakhically speaking, as being brain death, which a lot of poskim are not prepared to do. So you therefore you're covered in the sense that you have the individual say, I'm going to go to my rabbinic authority and let the rabbinic authority, you know, make these types of determinations. Furthermore, is one last consideration, and I promise after that I'm going to take questions, okay? Last consideration is, let's say that it really would count. Let's say that you can make a halakhic argument that there is a certain breakdown of the brain that would be so thorough and so absolute that it would count as death from a halakhic perspective. We have to figure out what are the possible sources over here. Well, we know that the Mishnah in Olo says very clearly that if you chop off the head of an animal, the animal is dead. Okay, you could chop off the head of a person, the person is considered to be dead. It doesn't matter. If the heart is beating at that point, it's not going to be for too long. If you chop off the head, so then the person is dead. We're not dealing with people, for the most part, whose heads are chopped off. Okay, but maybe you can say, well, just like, and the Mishnah even says, even though there might be what we call pirchus, that there's still some motion, there's still some motor movement in the limbs, like with a lizard, you chop off a lizard's head and the tail is still going to be twitching for a while. That's called pirchus, but it's not considered to be meaningful from a halakhic perspective. So some want to say, well, the beating of a heart, maybe that counts as pirchus if you chopped off the head. Again, we're not chopping off the head over here. But some came up with an idea, and again, all of these opinions have a basis in halakha. I happen to be close to most or many of the different participants in this very rigorous halakhic debate. I grew up in Muncie and Rabbi Moshe David Tendler Shul, who's the advocate of defining halakhic death as brain death. I went to yeshiva and up to Ad HaYom HaZeh. I have a relationship with Rabbi J. David Bleich, who's one of the fiercest opponents to brain death being used as a definition of halakhic death. So I'm familiar with many of the people who are involved in this dispute, and this should be a respectful presentation, obviously, of the different opinions. But Rabbi Tendler makes the argument that, well, if physical decapitation can constitute death, so too physiological decapitation. If the brain just has completely melted down and liquefied, or it's just not functional anymore, so then it has no there's no connection between the body and the brain, right? You do a nuclei test and you show that there is nothing that is being fed from one direction into the other. So maybe under those circumstances, we should define this as halakhic of death as well, okay? So Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says, you know what, I'm not convinced that just because you use like the apnea test and various tests that have been performed to show that the brain is not functioning, that the brain is really not completely functioning, says Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. But he said that theoretically, I guess, that you could have a situation where the brain liquefies so much that there's just nothing going on in the brain. The truth of the matter is, as long as the heart is beating, that really doesn't seem to be true. He identifies what's known as the hypothalamus problem. What's the hypothalamus problem? Hypothalamus, you know, those are those animals, they swim in the waters in Africa. No. Hypothalamus is a part of the brain stem that regulates body temperature. So even after there appears to be, if you do a standard apnea test, a cessation of all brain functions, including the brain stem, and nothing really seems to be working, the hypothalamus still seems to function. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach talks about this. I wouldn't talk about it from a scientific perspective. What do I know? But he mentions it in his tshuvos. So therefore he says, so they should do a more rigorous test in order to show that even the hypothalamus isn't working anymore. Which it seems, based on modern science, you can't really do. It really does work. So he says that you could have a theoretical test where even he would agree that brain death is considered to be death, but the truth of the matter is that according to the standards that he required, those standards probably wouldn't be met. I remember I was in the home. He used to correspond to a certain doc with a certain doctor in Borough Park in the early 1990s is when he was writing this tshuva. I happened to be in the home of that doctor. I won't say why. I happened to be in the home of that doctor in the early 1990s at one point in time. They were very excited because as I was like sitting around the table and talking to them, they just got a fax from Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, which he clarified his position on brain death. And I think that this might have been that tshuva that came in at that moment, eventful moment in time. There I was, you know, right, you know, in at the precipice of history as the fax was coming in. But anyway, he says that even if you would be able to demonstrate that all of this had been met, he said it's very difficult, and he doesn't trust the doctors. And therefore he says something very, very momentous in his tshuvos, because this really relates to our discussion about living wills, and it's just important to know that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said this. He said that because of the fact that it's really, really difficult to make these types of determinations, therefore he strongly recommends, or he paskins, that it is improper for people to leave authorizations that they're going to be donating their organs in the event that they die, because he said that if you're going to make that type of authorization, it's a recipe for disaster, because it's almost a mikshol that you are going to lead the doctors to take the organs off of the body before it is absolutely dead, according to halacha. I found it. Okay? V'lechein hayos, shelitzarenu, lo zehirim klal b'zeh b'batei cholim. He writes Shebe Eretz Yisrael. He's writing for Israel. Lachain, so you could say he's only writing for Israel. Lo nachon lirshem atzmo ki muamad lahashtalah. That's what he writes. So he says that very clearly. Certainly for Eretz Yisrael, that's the way the Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach paskin, because he was also worried about that issue. We're going to just stop for a moment so I can take your questions before we go on. Yes.
Going in reverse. Okay. That present, the present moment. Let's just say 30 years from today, you can transplant a brain and bring somebody healthy that wasn't healthy. Was on that doorstep. Are you allowed to do that?
If you could transplant a brain?
Yes, an artificial brain.
Oh, an artificial brain?
No, not from a cadaver, an artificial brain.
Oh, so why not? You're not killing anybody.
No,
if you're not killing anybody and you could save somebody's life, then why not? Why not? We're all in favor of saving a person's life. I don't, you know, see a problem with that per se. Yes?
I have at least two questions. A number of years ago, about 30 years ago, I worked with NCS Swine. We had some seminars on organ donors and this topic. So they had me give the seminars. I remember reading a lot of Rabbi Bleich's articles and books. And as I recall, was there a minority shita that a cornea could be sarcoidosis nefashim because someone was blind?
Yes, there is a minority. Thank you. Rabbi Bleich says that among the other sneifim lahakel, that the various considerations for leniency says you could also take into account that some say that it is, the way he puts it, is that it's sakanas nefashis not to be able to see. That if a person doesn't see, so then it's considered sakanas nefashis. He does mention that,
so
yes.
Besides that, and here's a tough issue, I know about my mother when she had kidney failure, and the doctor's attitude, and the Jewish doctor was, and I remember his exact words were, I helped my father die, I helped my brother die last month, I'll give him morphine, and we'll ease the patient into death. And when the emotions run high, obviously, I probably said some things to him that shouldn't have been said. But when I encountered that, when I was teaching, and I was teaching about death and dying in Jewish life cycle, and I mentioned the concept of hastening death, and maybe I went too far, because one girl started crying in class and said, "You're calling my mother a murderer." How, I know how I answer it, but how would you answer that in such a situation? When obviously they don't know halacha, they're trying to ease the patient and ease the patient's pain. But it doesn't seem so unusual today.
You say, well, there might have been extenuating circumstances in your mother's particular case, where maybe according to certain postgame there may have been certain leniencies, and we can discuss that separately. That's what you answer. May not necessarily be true, but who knows? Maybe it would be true. So therefore, you can just forestall that discussion.
Is it becoming more of an issue in the medical society that they're easing people into death?
It is an issue. There were recent articles that were written by a couple of medical journals that I came across. You should know about this whole DDR rule, the dead donor rule. So one article said, this whole thing about brain death, where did it come from, this whole thing about brain death? In the secular world, it came from some Harvard doctors in 1968, and they were trying to establish rules for when maybe it would be appropriate to disconnect people from ventilators and things of that sort. And they said, well, if you have cessation, irreversible cessation of all brain functions, including the brain stem, so therefore we're going to define that as the death of the brain. And somehow people looked at this and said, oh, that sounds good, let's just call it brain death. They weren't necessarily claiming that this constitutes death. They were saying it's the death of the brain. If you have death of the brain, so, why not start disconnecting people from the life support systems, because we can use our medical resources in a more constructive fashion. And people looked at this, and somehow it started to get incorporated into the laws of different states as an alternative definition of death. There were a few different reasons why this was useful. One, it enabled organ donation of the heart and the liver. Now, because the heart could still be beating when the brain breaks down. Number two, it just put a person on a ventilator, right? Number two, it enables the hospitals to be able to utilize their scarce medical resources on individuals who are likely going to have a more viable chance of being kept alive in a meaningful fashion. Therefore, it's helpful, for that reason as well. Number three, from the standpoint of families who just watch as they have these elderly family members, or maybe even not so elderly family members who are in a terrible accident, be sustained in a way in which there's no way to communicate with them. They're just sort of lying still, and the heart is beating, but nothing else is really going on. So it gives them an out that they can say, okay, we're going to accept this definition of death. So on many different levels, it's therapeutic or economically beneficial. So one medical journal said, but it's not really true that if you look at the brain, you have the hypothalamus, you have different, you still have a homeostasis, which is being maintained in various ways. The blood pressure is somehow still being regulated by the brain, even after we've declared brain death. So they say, it's just not true. Since it's just not true, let's stop harvesting the heart and the liver. Sort of like a Rabbi Bleich approach. It's not true. It's not really death to stop killing people. And another medical journal said, no, I have another approach. It's true. The brain is still functioning, but let's just do away with this idea that we have to have DDR, dead donor rule. So they surveyed lots of people, and lots of people said, okay, so they're not dead, but still, there's no reason to keep them alive. So let's just do away with this idea that a donor has to be dead. Maybe if a donor isn't dead, the Rabbi Wiener approach, not this, your approach would say that there's something in between. They're not quite dead, but they're almost dead. They're dead enough. To have the dead enough donor rule, okay? The DEDR rule, the dead enough donor rule, that it's enough, they're dead enough, even if they're not completely dead. Now, of course, halacha wouldn't really count against that, but you should know these are articles. I'm not quoting articles from 1970. I'm quoting articles from 2012, from 2018. I'm quoting articles that have just been written very, very recently.
Has it evolved much over the 30 years?
What?
Has it evolved much in terms of different...
The way it's evolved is that it has become the definition of death in every single jurisdiction. In the United States, there are two alternative definitions of death. One is cardiorespiratory death, circulatory death, and the other is cessation of all brain functions, including the brain stem, that can also count as death. You have that in virtually every single state. There's a Gemara. There's a Gemara in Yuma that says that if you have an avalanche that falls on somebody on Shabbos, so you're supposed to clear away the avalanche, even though it involves malachos, in order to save somebody's life, because maybe they're still alive, right? So how do you check them out in order to evaluate if they're still alive? So if you're going from the feet first, so then we have a machlokus, whether you check the heart or whether you go until the nose, whether you have to check for the respiration in the nose. But if you're going from the head first, of a puppet said, everybody agrees that it's good enough to just check the nose. So why is it just good enough to check the nose? So if you just look, says, well, right? In the connection with the flood. Everybody died. So he quotes a pasuk. So it seems that from the simple text of the Gemara, that the main test is the ICSR test, the reversible cessation of spontaneous respiration. Because you don't have to check to see if the heart is still beating. However, if you look at Rashi on the Gemara, so Rashi on that Gemara says, now why is it that it's good enough to check the nose for spontaneous respiration? Because if there's no spontaneous respiration, it means that there's no heartbeat. So some say, well, Rashi got his science wrong, because that's not true. Since it's not true that just because there's no spontaneous respiration, there'll be no heartbeat. You could still have a heartbeat, even if there's no spontaneous respiration, because the heartbeat doesn't depend upon the brain per se, or the spontaneous respiration per se. So Dr. Avraham Steinberg, whom I respect very much also, says, well, if he got the science wrong, so therefore we have to go back to a different pshat in the Gemara, and all that matters is really spontaneous respiration. Not a terrible argument, but the Chacham Tzvi said that the Chacham Tzvi had a tshuva where a girl was cleaning out a chicken that had been shechted, and she couldn't find the heart. So there was a big question, was the chicken a trefa because it was living, it was running around for a long time without a heart? So was it a trefa because, you know, you can't really live so long without a heart? So Chacham Tzvi said, no, this chicken is 100% kosher. How could a chicken be 100% kosher if it's living without a heart? Because then nobody can live without a heart! There's no living being that can live without a heart. Obviously, the chicken had a heart, and the heart fell out. It was taken away by a cat or something as they were cleaning out the chicken. Of course it had a heart. And the Chacham Tzvi, Shal quotes the Zohar, he says that the heart is the essence of every single living organism. And he quotes and he discusses this Rashi, and he says that Rashi is basically reinforcing this point by saying that as long as the heart is still beating, that is what defines a person as being alive. And that's why Rashi says, the only reason I'm really checking in the nose is because maybe if you're going to check just the heart, there's the rib cage is blocking, you're not necessarily going to be able to hear the heartbeat. So that's why you have the secondary test of checking for respiration, because maybe the heart's really beating and you wouldn't be able to tell just by listening to the heart, but you'll be able to tell much better through the spontaneous respiration test. So, since the Chacham Tzvi basically is saying this is the halacha, whether or not Rashi got the science right, clearly this is the halacha. Rashi is articulating a rule of what the halacha is in terms of how we define life. She says that's how we define life. Now, the Chassam Sofer dealt with a different question. In the Chassam Sofer's time, shortly before the Chassam Sofer was handed this question, was a whole big brouhaha with the Duke of Mecklenburg, I think. The Duke of Mecklenburg in his region had ruled that everybody should leave over their corpses for a period of 3 days before death is declared. Why should everybody leave over their corpses for 3 days before death is declared? Because maybe they're not really dead. There's even a case, actually we have in our Maseches Makos, a case where they had a question mark. If you visit the crypts, where they used to bury people in crypts, if you visit the crypts, there was a minhag that some people had, they would visit the crypts the first 3 days after a person died. Is that dakhay ha'emori? Is that just following the ways of the goyim the ways of the superstitious nations, and therefore you shouldn't do it or not. It's a problem of b'chukoseichem lo seleichu, or is that considered to be okay? So the Masechta Smacha says it's not a problem of b'chukoseichem to go and visit the crypts, because it was one time they visited the crypt within 3 days after a person died, and it turned out that the person was really alive. They turned out that they discovered that the person inside the crypt was saying, "Hey, let me out of here!" Whatever they said. And then the individual went on to live for another 25 years. So therefore they said, they didn't say, and therefore we should stop burying people, but they said, therefore, it's not considered to be a dalkei ha'emori, it's not considered to be an illicit practice, because once every 50 years, maybe you'll discover somebody who's still alive. But since, by and large, people are really dead, so therefore that's going to be okay. So some people, so Moses Mendelssohn and others, were quoting the Masechta Smachos and saying, oh, we should go along with this decree of the Duke that we should keep people for 3 days, because we don't want to bury people who might still be alive. Sam Sofer said that we never did that. Kavortik Perenu Bayomahu says you got to bury a person right away when they die, and they didn't change their practices when they discovered this person in the crypt. They just said it wasn't Darkei Amori. And he says, because we have a tradition that once there's no longer any breath coming out of the nose, there's no spontaneous respiration, a person is dead. How do we know that? He said, I don't know, maybe there were some really expert doctors that reviewed this many, many years ago, and therefore Chazal codified on that basis. Maybe it's our local emotion in Sinai. Maybe it's Xerah Sakasu, Kosher Nishmas Ruach Chayim Be'apav. For one of those three reasons, that's how we define death. And therefore, he says he's writing a tshuva to his Talmid Maritz Chias. Therefore, that's why we have no problem burying a person right away without any further verification once we determine that there's no spontaneous respiration. So therefore, some say, here's a good proof that all we need is a cessation of spontaneous respiration, even if there's a heartbeat. Problem is, towards the end of that very same tshuva, the Ksam Sofer says, therefore, all that we need to establish death is that a person is as still as a stone, which, by the way, is also part of the Lashon of Rashi in that Gemara in Yuma. The person should be as still as a stone. And number two, that there's no spontaneous respiration. And number three, there's no heartbeat. So Sam Sofer himself threw in, and by the way, there's no heartbeat. So how can you bring a proof from the Ksam Sofer? It doesn't matter if a person still has a heartbeat, they can be dead. And the Ksam Sofer himself said that this is one of the different components that are necessary in order to declare somebody dead. And finally, you have that Mishneh Nolos that talks about the decapitation. So Rambam, in his Perush HaMishnayos, on that Mishnah, talks about how, Pirchus, if we saw some twitching after the head is cut off, it doesn't matter anymore because it's not coming from any kind of central source from which all life is governed within the body, and therefore it doesn't count. So some say, based on that Ksam Sofer, so if you don't have like the neurological part of the body that is regulating the entire body, so then according to the way the Rambam understands physical decapitation, that constitutes death even if I have physiological decapitation. Although you can argue, we saw from the hypothalamus, as Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said, that there still is some regulation going on. But a second way of understanding the Rambam in the Perush HaMishnayos and the Mishneh Nolos is that the Rambam is saying that if I have like an uneven, uncoordinated, movement that is like a spasmic movement that has no type of a steadiness to it, so then that is not meaningful once the head is cut off. But if I have a steady and regular ongoing heartbeat, so how can you possibly put that in the same category? A heartbeat is not a twitching of a tail. The heart can continue to beat for a long time after there is no activity in the brain, and certainly if it's connected to a ventilator. So you should know that this is a very, very heated debate. There are many poskim who take the position, including the Tzitz Eliezer, including the Shevet Halevi, including here in Chicago, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, including Yibadul Chaim Rabbi Bleich. Many, many poskim will take the position that it is completely untenable to accept this new definition of death, this brain death definition that even the secular world only adopted since 1968, and to apply it to halacha. And therefore, the idea of donating organs when a person is between a state, most people are not going to be in the state. This is only like if there's traumatic injury or something like that. Or sometimes when a person, when they die in such a way that they'll be in the state between brain death and cardiorespiratory death. It won't happen to most people, but it will happen from a time to time, they feel that it's completely untenable. But that's nice if you feel that way, so maybe then you're not going to donate your organs. But what's to stop the hospitals from disconnecting the person from life-sustaining medical equipment when the hospital determines that the person is brain dead? What happens then? Do you have a religious exemption? There's only one state in the entire United States that has a religious exemption that says that if a family comes forward, let's say that they are Orthodox Jews or Native Americans, there are different groups that are very offended by the definition of a brain death. So let's say that that group comes forward and registers a religious exemption. New Jersey says that the hospital is not allowed to declare a person dead if a family in New Jersey says that we don't accept brain death and the person still has a heart that is beating, so then the hospital is still obligated to keep them on life support and is not allowed to declare them dead. For however long it takes. But there are three, however long they continue to live. But there are three other states, it's usually not that long, like a few weeks maybe, but sometimes it could be longer. But there are three states that actually do not allow for this religious exemption, but they do require that the state provides religious accommodation. That they require religious accommodation. One is New York, one is California, and one is... Illinois. I will read to you the Illinois statute. The Illinois statute goes like this. Every hospital must adopt policies and procedures to take into account the patient's religious beliefs concerning the patient's time of death. So the question is, what does that mean, take into account? What does take into account mean? The New York statute said that they have to apply reasonable accommodation. So reasonable accommodation, taking into account, might just mean we're going to be nice. We're going to be nice that we're going to hold the hands of the family and say, you know what? We really feel bad that we have to disconnect your father from the ventilator, but you know that according to our law, this constitutes death. So we feel really, really bad about it. Please forgive us. Or we'll keep them on for another 24 hours, but that's it. It doesn't really define the parameters of reasonable accommodation. So it was just a case. It's very, very interesting. There was just a case. It was called the Nakar case. Nakar versus, I think, Columbia Presbyterian Hospital in New York, in which a person actually was diagnosed with brain death. They were declared dead according to brain death tests. But the family was an Orthodox Jewish family. The person who died, his name was Yecheskel Nakar. And the family did not want that the person should be declared dead. And apparently the hospital said, oh, we'll take into account your concerns. And we have an ethical committee that's going to meet about this. But then, I don't know if the family went home. It's not entirely clear from the case. I have the case here somewhere. That the family, that over Shavuos, this occurred over the Shavuos holiday, May 31st, 2018, the hospital did a test, and they declared that the person was brain dead. And they issued a declaration of death. They actually issued a death declaration of this individual. But they were nice enough not to take them off life support entirely. They just sent them to a nursing home. The nursing home refused them. Then they got them to go to Maimonides Hospital. Maimonides Hospital wasn't told that the person had already been declared dead. And then eventually they died in Maimonides Hospital 3 weeks later through cardiorespiratory death. And the family of Nakar brought an action in court, in the New York State Supreme Court, that they wanted to reverse the death certificate so that they could get insurance benefits between the time of May 31st when the person was declared brain dead and apparently June 22nd when the person suffered cardiorespiratory death. They brought in Rabbi Bleich to testify. They brought in Rabbi Zvi Bell. Very, very fascinating case. The court ruled that the reasonable accommodation requirement of the statute in New York had been violated. Why had it been violated? Because the family didn't know what was going on. It was during the Shavuos holiday. They didn't have a full meeting of the ethical committee. They didn't do this in consultation with the family when they issued the death certificate, and therefore they had exceeded their bounds. And the court actually ruled, I don't know how this takes place, that the hospital was required to do everything in its power in order to reverse the issuance of the death death certificate so that the death certificate should be reissued for June 22nd as opposed to May 31st. Ramifications, obviously, with respect to the yard site. But this is the finding of the court. Rabbi Black said that this is good because up until now, for all we knew, that reasonable accommodation just meant you have to be nice. So now, at least in New York, it's clear that it requires something more substantial.
But that wouldn't affect yes. the York site because he's not dead according
no,
to
No, no, of course. I was
but
just, you know, saying that, you know, to make a point. Yes.
Rabbi Zalman Nechemia Goldberg and the Rabbanut in Israel follow
the
brain
death. The Rabbanut in Israel does follow brain
death. Rabbi Schwartz follows brain death.
Yes, there are a number of eminent post-Gim. Rabbi Tendler, certainly the chief rabbi follows it as well. But the point of the matter is just so you should get a sense of the difference.
But CPR, you can, if somebody's heart or lung stops, you can do CPR, and they can come back. But when Rabbi Tendler was here in Chicago and spoke, he said, there has never been a case where brain death with the apnea test, nobody has ever come back
except that there
after
are
brain death.
But there are cases where they misdiagnosed brain death.
They misdiagnosed,
and
but there's
back.
Never been a case.
There was a case of a person who was misdiagnosed, and they went on like all the talk shows about how, you know,
yeah,
there was
but that's
brain
misdiagnosed.
Death.
That's
right. If they are properly diagnosed, so all we know is that the heart can continue to beat, but they don't come back.
And
right?
these hospitals, right. if you put down the name of a rabbi, they'll guide it. The
right,
rabbi's going to decide.
Exactly. So that's why it's just important to know what the issues are. I'm not endorsing a particular position. I'm giving you some in the Mekoros that the various Rabbanim argue about and how they interpret the different sources. But we can see that there really is a divergence of opinion, not only in halacha, in secular law as well, with respect to the brain dead issue. And this has direct ramifications with respect to the parameters about the donation of organs after death, because much of this donation is only going to make sense if a person accepts that definition, which is why it's important that everybody should consult with their halakhic authorities. A person can do one of two things: to indicate what their preferences are in terms of organ donation, and then indicate who the halakhic authority is that should make decisions
right,
based on that statement of preferences. And we'll stop here.
Okay. Can you